WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is one of the founding fathers of Israel, Abba Iban. After World War II, he negotiated for an independent Jewish state with Great Britain, which had been administering Palestine under a League of Nations mandate since 1923. In 1947, Iban made the case for a Jewish state to the United Nations. When Israel achieved statehood, Iban became his country's first ambassador to the UN. During most of the 10 years he held that position, he also served as Israel's ambassador to the United States. He's held many other prominent positions in Israel, including deputy prime minister, minister of foreign affairs, and member of the Knesset. Iban was born in South Africa, grew up in England, served in Palestine during World War II, and remained there after the war. Iban recently described himself as one of the last central witnesses to the drama of Israel's birth. He's committed to documenting that history. His new book is a memoir called Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. He also hosts a new public TV series called Israel, A Nation Is Born. This is an excerpt of a speech that Abba Iban made to the United Nations in 1956.
We know that Israel is most popular when it does not hit back, and world opinion is profoundly important to us. So on one occasion after another, we have buried our dead, tended our wounded, clenched our teeth in suppressed resentment and hope that this very moderation will deter a repetition of the offense. But sometimes the right and duty of self-preservation prevails in the final and reluctant decision.
Do you remember the occasion of that address?
Yes, it was on the 1st of November at midnight, 1956. And the address was in the context of a war that was then going on between Israel and the Egyptians. For once, we were supported by two major powers, by Britain and France. But what I said in those few remarks really summarized the entire Israeli condition. Here we were, having been a state for 8 years, and yet constantly attacked, having the waterways blocked against us, having our water threatened, and having daily incursions into our country for people coming to plunder and to kill. And this was a sort of a cry of the heart against the continuation of that situation, and a hope that the international community would try to give us that kind of security that it does give to every other state in the international community.
You said in that speech, Israel is most popular when it does not hit back. Do you think Israel has had to defend its right to use force in ways
that
never would be expected of other countries?
More recently, I think we've had more understanding for our need to respond when we are attacked, especially since in 1967, there was a feeling across the world that we had carried patience perhaps a little too far. Here were the Egyptians with 100,000 troops and 1,000 tanks in Sinai. Here were the Syrians poised for an attack in the north. Here were wild crowds in all the Arab countries calling for our blood. Here were Iraqi and Moroccan troops converging upon us. And the world watched with breathless indignation, but also suspense, to see if and when we would be able to respond. I think that since those days, it's been fully understood that one way of encouraging aggression is simply to submit to it. And therefore, the feeling that we should never hit back and should simply turn our other cheek, I think that has been less marked in recent years than before.
How possible do you think a true and lasting peace is between Israel and its Arab neighbors and the Palestinians?
Well, first of all, it's a reality. It's a reality in relation to the Arab and Muslim state, which took the lead in all the wars against Israel. One must understand that a peace treaty with Egypt completely refutes the idea of the irreconcilability of conflicts. There is no such thing as an irreconcilable conflict. And therefore, peace is something of which you should never despair. Peace happens when there is a convergence of self-interest on behalf of a peaceful solution, and therefore it's an intelligent thing to do to keep working at it, not to despair of it, especially when the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty has worked so well.
The peace talks are stalled now, and the Palestinians in the occupied territories just voted against accepting Israel's offer of partial autonomy because they thought it didn't go far enough. Do you think that these talks will continue and lead to anything, or are you concerned about their future?
Of course, they're going to lead to agreements, undoubtedly. The fact that at the moment our positions are not identical, that's almost an inane thing to say because the media, which are professionally devoted to pessimism, keep asking us every week or month, well, you haven't reached an agreement yet. Well, let's not forget that Anwar Sadat came to Jerusalem in November 1977. A peace treaty was signed in March 1979, and the last Israeli forces left Sinai sometime in 1982. Therefore, don't ask for a quick fix, because there is a long background and record of distrust and a total lack of mutual confidence. But the fact that we're talking together with civility and in a context of examining issues, substantive issues, think of what's happened in the past year. It's not a wasted year. During that year, Syria has passed from virulent non-recognition and hatred to what they call a policy of wanting total peace. During that year, the Palestinians have been studying the kind of projects and proposals which they vehemently rejected only a year and a half ago. Here they're discussing these. Here we have Jordan coming up every week with a proposal for a peace treaty with Israel. And here there's now an Israeli government which has changed tangentially in the past year from asking for 100% of territory and 100% of sovereignty and 100% of everything to what I call the lucid and visionary ideas of our founding fathers, namely that since there are two nations within the Palestinian area, therefore you cannot have one state completely dominating all the others, that something has to be shared. Territory has to be shared and sovereignty has to be shared. All of that within a single year as a result of the Gulf War and of the collapse of communism. And if there are now periods of halting, which there are, it's your fault. It's the fault of the United States, because it's impossible to imagine that we're going to reach binding agreements without a third party. Our experience tells us that whenever you have an Arab and an Israeli delegation, each of those two can accept from a trusted third party something which neither of them can initiate itself, and neither of them can expect from its adversary.
How
can't
important.
Initiate themselves because of domestic constituencies, and can't accept from the rival party for fear of looking weak. And therefore, the American role is vital, and of course it's suspended because of what I might call your almost infinitely long electoral processes.
You grew up in a Zionist house. Your mother was a Zionist, and in fact she translated the Balfour Doctrine into French and Russian in 1979, and that was the doctrine that promised a Jewish home in Palestine. What did Zionism mean to you as a boy?
Well, first of all, there was this family experience, something exalted that had lit up our sky, and the glow of it would never be lost, because there in the middle of the First World War, we had this extraordinary visionary leadership of Chaim Weizmann, who thought that he could get the British government, then the strongest in the world, to adopt the Zionist program for the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. Now, that was a typically Zionist idea, 90% fantasy and 10% realism. And yet here, within a few years, this breakthrough had occurred. Jews were not suffering as they were later to suffer under Nazism, but they were suffering pretty sharply in the Russian Empire, and they remembered the Inquisitions. The Jews were not equal in their status for very many years in Europe. And therefore, although I was perfectly peaceful and tranquil as a Cambridge Don and had no personal need to join this very embattled and rather precarious cause, I felt when the Holocaust took place during the Second World War, I felt that I ought to put my allegiance and my person in the same place. And I was so captivated by the Zionist idea that I thought I should give it my full loyalty. I therefore gave up my prospects of continuing my academic career at Cambridge or joining the British Foreign Office or even running for Parliament. All these abilities, possibilities were in my hands, and I went right over to the very embattled and precarious Zionist cause.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Abe Iban, and he was Israel's first ambassador to the United Nations. He's served in the cabinet of several prime ministers. He's been a longtime member of the Knesset. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Abe Iban, one of the founding fathers of Israel. He's the author of a new memoir called Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. And he's also the host of a new public TV series called A Nation Is Born, Personal Witness. After Israel became a nation, Israel was attacked just as the celebrations were continuing. What were your feelings right after independence with these mixed emotions of feeling very, very elated and victorious at statehood, but knowing that you were going to be under attack?
We didn't have any time for celebration because our state was established by a declaration of independence on the 14th of May, and of course that was received with delirious joy. At the same time, the United States, by order of President Truman, recognized our statehood within 11 minutes of our proclaiming it, and the Soviet Union also joined in that recognition. So that was on the positive side. The bad news was that the Arab countries, which had not entered the state, Israel, in their capacity as armies of states, all converged upon us. We were no longer being attacked by guerrillas, by private armies, but by the armies of five Arab states, full of armaments, outweighing our own very poor armaments. And therefore, I would say that we felt the joy of birth and the fear of death in the same moment.
What has been one of the most difficult decisions you have had to make on issues of war and peace in Israel?
In 1967, we had to take a vote because here were the Arab states converging upon us, getting nearer and nearer to our population centers, intoxicated by the apathy of the international community. As you know, the United Nations very unwisely withdrew its peace forces just when we needed those peace forces most to prevent belligerency and to save the peace, and we were in very great danger. We had to decide when and if to vote for war. And I advocated restraint because I said, first of all, we must avoid a situation in which we win the war and are then thrown back as we were in 1956 by a joint action of the United States and the Soviet Union. So I said, well, let me go to Washington and to Paris and to London and see if we can get support so that even if they don't help us in the field, which we never asked for, they wouldn't just throw us back. And therefore, I had to call for over nearly three weeks of delay. And then one day on the 5th of June, everybody had to vote. Our Prime Minister, Mr. Eshkol, said he wants everybody to vote for or against. You can't just dodge this issue. And I saw my hand going up with all the other hands. Yes, we were just going to war.
Why was it such a difficult decision for you to make to vote to go to war?
Because according to all the statistics, we had no certainty of winning. The fact that in 6 days we had this spectacular victory was always regarded as almost impossible. We thought that we would... our hospitals were prepared for tens of thousands of casualties. Graves were being dug. That was the atmosphere in which we then voted.
After the Six-Day War, you tried to begin peace talks with the Arabs. What did you try to do?
We thought, perhaps unrealistically at the time, that because they were so battered and defeated and demoralized, that would be a good time for them to think of peace. Well, that turned out not to be true. Perhaps we shouldn't have believed that. It was the fact that they were defeated and demoralized that made it more difficult for them to come to the table because they had lost their pride. And they had no reason to regard the military situation created by the Six-Day War as a realistic reflection of their strength. It didn't reflect their strength. And within a few months, they had replenished their arms. After all, no Arab government fell and no Arab capital was captured. And therefore, it was perhaps wrong on our side to believe that they would start peace negotiations on the basis of the extremely inferior balance of power which existed then. They had to restore their pride. Well, they did this, I'm afraid, at the expense of many Israeli losses in 1973. But on the positive side, the fact that their pride was not humiliated made them more congenial for peace, and we did have a peace conference at Geneva in the end of 1973.
If the time wasn't right after the Six-Day War, what do you think makes the time right now for peace talks?
Well, it's right now because I would say that there's more humility in Israel and less depressive lack of confidence in the Arab states. Moreover, there's the attritional effect of time. If the Arabs had a chance of getting their territory back without peace, surely they'd have achieved that by now. After all, it's 15 years since the Six-Day War. And if Israel had a chance of getting peace while keeping all the territories, well, why hasn't that happened yet? And as I once said, and I noticed the Oxford Book of Quotations has quoted me as once saying that men and nations behave wisely once they have exhausted all the other alternatives. I really think that the Arabs and Israel have exhausted all the other alternatives except making peace with each other.
Now, you really never believed that Jews and Arabs could coexist in the same state without one submitting to the other. Why did you never believe that?
Well, because it's obviously true. Let us examine that a unitary state had been established in Palestine in 1948. The Arabs would have been, what was it? They would have been over a million, and we would have been 600,000. So we would have been a minority, and we have pretty clear knowledge they wouldn't have treated us with any tolerance. Now, supposing it was the other way around, and that now Israel were to take over the whole of the government in a single state, we would have 1,800,000 Palestinian Arabs, members of a different nation, who do not share our flag or our faith or our tongue or our national experience, and they would have a very bad time of it. They would be humiliated. Therefore, the best thing is to have an arrangement in which both we and they can have our separate domains of independence. We in our own Israel, they perhaps by associating themselves with Jordan, and that therefore there would not be anybody, any condition in which either all the Israelis or all the Palestinians would be under the rule of a foreign power.
What, if any, responsibility do you think Israel has to Palestinians in the diaspora who were displaced by the creation of Israel?
I don't think we can do anything more except to make peace on the basis of the existing populations. After all, not all the Jews are going to be or are today under a sovereign Israeli flag. You can't say that the Arabs have got to have sovereignty wherever there are Arabs. And frankly, many of them, I see in your own country, in the United States, are not exactly the subjects of compassion or misery. They're not like the Bosnians. They have people in very high positions and high ranks. Even those who are outside the Palestine context would take pride in the knowledge that there did exist a nation with a Palestinian identity, just as Jews, even if they live in the United States or in Argentina or in Paris or anywhere, or in their own Russia, have a feeling that there is a Jewish state to which they could have recourse and shelter if necessary. But it doesn't mean to say that all the Jews of the world have any intention of putting themselves under the Israeli flag. And that must be the answer for the Arab states as well. On the other hand, if there was a peace, we could develop areas in the Middle East, develop water, for example, develop the port at Eilat together. Why should we have two ports within a few miles of each other? Develop the Dead Sea. Why should you have a sea divided between Israel and Jordan when they could develop it together?
You were in Israel when it was created as a nation. What do you think the importance of Israel is today to the identity and the security of Jews around the world?
Well, Israel is really the center of Jewish pride. It ensures the legacy. It consecrates the language. It is only in Israel that Jews face the world in their own identity, not just as a gloss on the life of other countries. Here we are, as we are, in our own identity, with our own faith, with our own tongue, with our own history. I think therefore Jews stand very tall within their own frame of reference.
I want to quote something from the end of one of your previous books, your previous autobiography. You wrote in the end there, "I was disturbed by the excessive emphasis that diaspora Jewry places on the question of image. This obsessive concern arises out of a special Jewish experience. What other people have thought about Jews has often been an issue of life and death." Would you elaborate on that for us?
Well, there's a great sensitivity, especially amongst diaspora Jews, about not what Israel does or how Israel is, but what we look like. And really, that's, Israelis always think of what do people do for us. And Israelis and diaspora Jews consider what do people say about us. For example, there was an exchange of rhetoric between the United States and Israel. This didn't attach much. Israelis didn't attach much importance because, although the United States administration was arguing with us, they were also shoveling arms into us and abolishing the anti-Zionist resolution and pressing the Russians and the Ethiopians to open the gates. So we had a very positive picture of the American attitude to Israel. But Israelis just heard rumors that American leaders were talking about us in a not very complimentary way. I must say Israelis talk about other people also in a not very complimentary way. But these problems of how we look seem to affect Jews outside Israel more than they interest Jews inside Israel.
Why do you think that Jews outside Israel are more affected by image than Jews inside?
Because the Israeli spectacle, the Israeli reality affects them in terms of image. They don't pay taxes, they don't join our army. So what does Israel do for them? It increases their pride. It makes them feel good. And therefore, they very often ask this question, what does it look like? And they want us to succeed on television shows, on radio shows. I remember once going to some meeting in the Council of Foreign Relations, in which there were about 10% of the people were Jews. The Jews weren't listening to me at all. They were looking at the non-Jews to see if the non-Jews were reacting favorably to what I was saying. That's a difference of emphasis.
Do you ever find that damaging?
No, I think it's natural. Everybody is the product of his own particular reality.
Abba Iban, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Abba Iban has written a new memoir called Personal Witness, Israel Through My Eyes. He hosts a series called Israel, A Nation Is Born that will soon be broadcast on many public television stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.